Lied für den Kerschewer Pogrom. Ach, ich peise von der Nacht, ist er ruhig von einer Roska, auf jeden zum Liegen behaupten, sie tun sich nicht drehen in Gau, auf jeden zum Liegen behaupten, sie tun sich nicht drehen in Gau. Oh, süße Gott im Himmel, kiek schön auf der Sein auf dem raschen Getimmel, wo's haben die Jeden verwehrt. Sein auf dem raschen Getimmel, wo's haben die Jeden verwehrt. Aho, wir sind drei Guren, haben gelegt bis zu dem Grin. Bett gewandt hat mein gerissen, die Federn gelost auf dem Wind. Bett gewandt hat mein gerissen, die Federn gelost auf dem Wind. Und die Federn ist mein gegangen, also wie Winter im Schnee. Faber hat mein geschlugen, Männer gerissen auf zwei. Faber hat mein geschlugen, die Männer zerrissen auf zwei. Süße Gott im Himmel, kiek schön auf der Wenn die Jeden so sind, wo sie haben gute Keime. Wo sind die Jeden so sind, wo sie haben gute Keime.
This writer, A.C. Chawlap, begs your indulgence for the murderous and merciless and monstrous, the brutal and barbaric, brutish and bloodthirsty, the cold-blooded and the callous, the savage and the sadistic, the atrocious and abominable sights to which he shall shortly subject you. After hearing this tale, I'm sure you will wonder whether the actions which A.C. Chawlap dramatizes to you are mere indicators that he looks on such actions with approval or approbation. The answer, my friends, is of course that he doesn't. And there's even a certain weariness to this writer who is no happier to concede horror's place in the cycle of nature than human history is to concede that horror is the greater share of her story and not the story of the world to come. And therefore, as history ever does, he begs your forgiveness. What is the old new land? Where is the old new land? It is the place where nothing need be possible because everything is already true. It's a place where propaganda is unnecessary because we're already willing to believe nothing but the best of each other. It is a place where cynicism need hold no refuge because the fantastic is always and already true, and no tactical cleverness of leaders can conjure a promise as fantastic as the world as it already is. No statement of fact can turn into a question of motive because fact and fiction are one and the same. Fiction is so plausible as to be indistinguishable from fact. Fact so absorbing as to be indistinguishable from fiction, and reality need never be fit to fiction because fiction is already distilled to the pure essence of truth. And because truth and fiction are indistinguishable, all actions become revolutionary. Revolution becomes more than an empty series of theatrical gestures. Every action becomes a battle for power in which the distribution between unequal individuals and groups become redistributed. The polity is reorganized and they no longer accept the appearances of their world as fact because fact and fiction are now one and the same and all things are possible. But in this moment when the fantastic is now attainable, it reveals to us fantasies we didn't want to conjure. And in order to forget it, a new power arises to rebuild the world of appearances and let us forget the horrors that we'd seen. The world appears to us again in sensible structures. Reality is reality, fantasy is fantasy, and responsibility is something for our leaders, not us. They work and they work and they work, and they wait and they wait and they wait, but we're always thrown out of the old new land. Last year, a big producer, a celebrity in his own right, came to talk to the USC film and theater students. Coleman would not repeat his name, but Steve had a decent idea of who it probably was and what studio he used to work for. Everybody in LA would, and even if it wasn't whom he thought, there were 1,000 less successful people in Hollywood just like him. Ethnic men too young to serve in World War II and thus self-motivated as it would never occur to their older brothers to be. Some of them served in Korea, but the ones who served are the ones with especially large chips on their shoulders. There were never enough troops in Korea to develop the unspoken bond of camaraderie their older brothers have instantly with any male peer they meet for the first time. And thus, without their elder brother's sense of sacrifice or necessity, without their sense of obligation to the common good, without their sense that the world will appreciate the contributions they make for others, without their memory of the dozen or two acquaintances lost to graves around the world, and without their sense that the lost are owed for the community contributions they'll never get to make. From 1946 to 1963, they descended upon L.A. from the east in swarms. A lot of New Yorkers, but nearly as many from Boston, from Providence, from Worcester, from New Haven, from Hartford, from Newark, from Jersey City, from Hoboken, from Camden, from Philly, from Trenton, from Atlantic City, from Wellington, from Baltimore. Whatever social class from which they originally hailed, being from an East Coast city gave them experience dealing with every background and social class. From the old society broads whose asses they had to lick to the colored doorman whose asses they got to kick, the experience that they all shared was that their parents sacrificed everything, particularly from them. Whatever innate gifts in life their fathers had, their fathers worked 7 days a week during their Great Depression childhoods to give his children everything the father ever wanted for himself, while their mothers, her innate gifts in life never even discovered, had literally no purpose in life except to work for her children. These parents had virtually no identities except as parents, and in no small part because of that, their children have no identity except their own. Cold men, hard men, forged with ethics from a harder time when survival depended on selfishness and sin, but let loose upon a time and place in which everything was warm and easy. Some children of Eastern Europeans descend on L.A. from the Midwest, but they're too nice to make it. They either disillusionedly return to fly over country after 3 years or become sad underlings. Politicians, buildings, and whores all get respectable if they last long enough. And the ones who make it descend upon the city of angels and slime with one goal, to become machers in a city where there are no goyim to remind them what good taste is. Even the old money here is gold money from the late 1800s. These are men that define taste. Not just for themselves and their friends, not just for Southern California, but for a nation and for a world. Thrill seekers, bookmakers, nature's gamblers, insider traders, every out is a potential in. The more down on your luck you are, the better the comeback. Guys for whom sex is pretty good, but a very distant second to the thrill of adding one to their lists, of retabulating the total, recalling the impediments of getting there, recalling the small details of what made this one different from that one, for fighting the heroic struggles of the forgotten generation, the silent generation, the pre-boomers, the Rat Pack generation. In the 1940s, their older brothers liberated Eurasia. But for the next half century, these guys made money, women, and America do things they shouldn't. Johns who always tell women that neither the John nor the lady's looks will be around forever. Joes prepared to make a deal because they're always prepared to ruin the deal. Fellas who will bond with you after 5 minutes like a best friend because at any moment they can become your worst enemy. Gents who've never lost at life because they never expect to lose. And even when they lose, they never admit it's a loss. Lads for whom fame was almost an impediment. The mobs of adoring crowds would slow them down from getting to the action as quickly as possible. Hollywood is a place where everybody's looking for a job, and these are the only guys who can offer them. Hollywood is a place where nobody can afford a car, and these are the guys with the coolest cars in America. Hollywood is a place where nobody moves with their parents' blessing. And these guys have made entire lives on granting displaced parental approval and criticism. They didn't want to be the actors sucking up for approval. They wanted to be the ones sucked as they bestowed approval or took it away. If they let themselves become more famous, it was so they'd have more to bet. No thrill is ever enough. No action leads to satisfaction, only to the need for more thrills. Even as they age, the thrills have to keep going, because if they ever stopped and looked back on their lives, they would see a trail of black holes which their thriving, throbbing, always moving lives leave in their wake. But these guys aren't thrill seekers like the thrill seekers from the heartland. They don't shoot big game or climb mountains or play football without a helmet. They're not men's men, because when a man's man comes from a family that hasn't made it yet in America, a man's man takes care of his family. These are ladies' men with a kind of dyed and slicked back hair with a spray tan that looks perfect on young men of an ethnic extraction. Men who look like boys until they're 50 and radiate boyish enthusiasm for every idea a woman has and are full of the kind of encouragement and well wishes no man's man ever gave them. Guys who think that they can read women because what anybody wants is particularly easy to read when you treat them like less than human for a million years. You see? It was that golden dawn of the sexual revolution after World War II when the American military finally advocated for something other than abstinence in their propaganda. Don't forget, put it on before you put it in. The military dropped the condom campaign immediately after the war, but the damage was done. And between 1955 and 65, 42% of young men admitted to wearing condoms, which means that the total was probably much higher, because how many unmarried young people wanted anybody to find out they were having sex? And for that matter, how many Catholics wanted anyone at all to find out they were using birth control? So for one brief and glorious moment on either side of 1960, all you had to do was make a woman feel like a person occasionally, and she would let you treat her like an animal. She would be so grateful that she'd bend over backwards for any request you made, or at least she would until she demands something realer than encouragement. But there's nothing real about a Weibernick, a Verführer trained in how to speak by Humphrey Bogart, how to groom by Cary Grant, how to intimidate by Marlon Brando, how to show vulnerability by Jimmy Stewart and Henry Fonda, how to banter by Grant and Spencer Tracy, how to be a man by Clark Gable and Gary Cooper and John Wayne, how to be mysterious from Bogart and Cooper and Robert Mitchum, how to ooze decency by Fonda and Stewart and Gregory Peck, Mention who learned how to think of a lady from Hugh Hefner, how to treat a lady from Sean Connery, how to get a lady in the mood from Bill Cosby, how to raise a lady up by Louis B. Mayer and how to ruin her from Harry Caan, how to leave a lady from Mickey Rooney, how to trade up to a better lady from Eddie Fisher, how to measure the acceptable difference of age from Charlie Chaplin and Errol Flynn and Woody Allen, how to hide their affairs from Rock Hudson and Liberace and Randolph Scott, and let loose on heartland chickses whose parents wouldn't let them see anything more dangerous than Walt Disney. Opnarists who specialize in the conjuration, the conjugal, and the con in a town so unconnected with reality that they think they can get away with anything, because for their first half century, they get away with everything. But these guys wake up on their 50th birthday to find that the three-pack-a-day habits turn their skin from olive to prune and their voices from mahogany to gravel. Their powerful best friends in business and government and academia don't return their calls and refuse to lift the phone to get them out of the kind of trouble that back in the 60s was never trouble in an era when all the world's powerful people were together in a conspiracy to convince the rest of us that they deserved their eminence. After 50, it's only a matter of time before they have to pay for some of what hundreds of thousands of women once paid with their happiness to do for them. Sometimes they're producers, sometimes they're distributors, sometimes they're executives, sometimes they're press, sometimes they're agents, sometimes they're even photographers and realtors. Sometimes they work in TV or animation, sometimes they work on blockbusters. Sometimes they work on little independent hits, sometimes they work on bombs and flops, but their job is always the same, to cut creative people down to size, to make the Luftmenschen and creative understand that what they do is usually bad, utterly unconnected to reality, and will never be understood by the guy buying two tickets for him in his date in Wahoo, Nebraska. To make creative understand that they're not that good, not that smart, and all that stands between them and a flop is someone with 100 times more seichel than they'll ever have. They spend every day of their lives around creative people, but no matter how many children they create and how many babies they've paid women to abort, they will never be creative themselves. These pieces of filth have never created anything in their lives, and no amount of pussy will displace the hole in their spirits that grows with every hit for which they're responsible. And that is what makes them so devastatingly effective towards creative people. The only thing they've created is nightmares in the beds of people with the kinds of imaginations they can only dream of having. People of vision who put their thoughts, their feelings, the very best of themselves into the center of the arena, all for the purpose of making other people's lives more meaningful, more satisfying, happier. And yet these bottom feeders are always there to tell them what they did wrong and suck the blood from them like leeches. The worst part about it is that more often than not, the parasites are right. And now we'd like to pause to tell you that we're broadcasting to you live from Duluth, Minnesota, place of origin for Rabbi Herbert Swamley when he was a Finnish Lutheran rather than an Orthodox rabbi. Rabbi Swamley has no idea that we're here and thinks, thankfully, that I'm not speaking to him after the events of the last podcast. But sometimes the best revenge is to steer directly into the wreck. So instead, I'm here with Rabbi Swamley's father, Wayne Swamley, to figure out exactly how Rabbi Swamley came to be the way he was. So, Wayne, please tell me about how your son was when he was young.
Well, actually, he's not completely Lutheran. My great-great-grandfather, Lucius Swamley, was a Presbyterian heretic from Scranton, Pennsylvania, who came to Duluth in search of a dirt farm and the freedom to marry his livestock.
Did he actually think people would smile on that in Minnesota?
Yes, but he was misinformed. And anyway, he didn't stay for long. Records show that in 1864, he was arrested as an itinerant preacher in Illinois for claiming that Native Americans should be baked in a stew.
So let me ask then, does fanaticism seem to be a family trait?
Not really. Nobody feels too strongly about anything here.
I sort of have that sense just walking around Duluth and seeing how mild people are.
Yes, it's been a quiet week in Herbert's hometown.
Is that good?
It's always a quiet week. Herbert didn't much like living with us. We're Lutherans. We're stoical people, tall people, blonde people. We don't smile much. We don't get angry. We're always polite. We don't like people who are different. We don't talk if we don't have to. We just sit at home and cook our lutefisk for Advent. You know what lutefisk is?
I've heard of it.
It's a disgustingly scaly oleaginous creature from the sea that smells like burnt rubber and tastes like a bird dropping landed in your mouth. It's the perfect food to remind you how bleak and terrible life is and how much we love it for being so horrible.
Really?
You might think it's a contradiction, but we understand it even if you don't. A nice meal complicates things. It just makes everybody worry about whether they can't properly appreciate a good thing because there's a stain on their pants or their father never said I love you to them.
Oh my.
So we just stick to our lutefisk and we go out to the lakes for 3 hours and fish in it for the rain, and it always seems to fall on the weekends. And in the winter we bundle up for the 5 feet of snow and the 40 degrees below zero to go ice fishing. For lutefisk, of course.
Sounds reliable.
Exactly. Sometimes there are beautiful fall days when the trees can be every color of the fall rainbow. Red, orange, yellow, brown. Sometimes even a healthy greens go with it. But we hate those days. They just remind us of how we can't appreciate them properly. On the most beautiful fall evenings, we just lock ourselves inside the church and practice for Christmas with the church choir.
You know, I've always heard that Lutherans are great singers.
No, we're terrible. We're always flat. We take 45-minute coffee breaks. We don't even really have much faith in God, but we're okay with that. We don't like ambition. We don't like ambitious people. You can't expect too much out of life. Everybody has ambition when they're young, and it makes them depressed, and makes them narcissistic, and it makes them more than any of us can ever bear. Eventually, you realize you just can't do anything with your life, and you just give up, and you become a much easier person to get along with.
Well, at least you have each other.
There's some comfort in that, a cold comfort. We're always friendly to everybody because we don't much like each other. But there's always something reassuring about knowing that Don Halverson will always snore during the sermon, or that Bill Berglund will always hawk a loogie in the trash can the moment after his first sip of coffee. and Lucy Alphen will always show you a new picture of her ugly grandchildren from her wallet. It's mildly annoying, but life is very long, so we take it easy and let the mild annoyances flow away.
But don't the mild annoyances pile up?
Not if you just forget about them from day to day. Eventually you grow to love the mild annoyances, a stamp of routine in an insane world, and you resent the people who want to do away with them.
Well, it sounds like a beautiful way of life.
Nobody wants to see the excrement crapped out by these artiste types who expect the world to believe that their shit doesn't stink. Most artists starve in their Harlem garrets to fart out product that nobody wants to see and would hate if they did. But the only reason to give tens of millions of dollars to a pampered pisher with a camera is so he can make a movie people want to watch. The job of these executive bloodsuckers is to make sure that the artists don't create multi-million dollar turds whose failures can put thousands of people out of work and endanger the safety and welfare of tens of thousands of families. Perhaps the very fact of this responsibility is awesome enough to justify the every reward, the every remuneration, the every enumeration. For what other reason than the importance of their responsibility would the world give them their pick of the world's flashiest houses, cars, suits, restaurants, and tits? And worst of all, as nature's bravados, their unfairest reward for the misery they cause is that occasionally their gambling compulsion makes them bet everything and more on an idea from a young unknown who came up with something really, really, really good. Not because they believed in the importance of quality, but just to feed the gambling itch that wonders if something good can be a hit. And to make it into a hit, they get to do what they do best. Yell and scream and bully and intimidate and cajole and apologize and forgive and seduce and repeat ad infinitum every day until the picture's done. At which point they get to do it all over again. So rather than be remembered for the slime they are, posterity remembers them as the avuncular Eminence Spray Noir, who believed in art and unknown talent during a golden age that was only golden because it was reckless. Entertainment makes money, but art costs money. And trying to make every work of art into something profitable is a gamble that is only won a few times in a generation. And yet, for roughly 16 years in Hollywood, from 1967 to 1983, these addicts won against the house more times than anyone thought was possible. The Godfather, The Graduate, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Taxi Driver, Apocalypse Now, Raging Bull, American Graffiti, Chinatown, Bonnie and Clyde, Godfather Part II, Rocky, Grease, Cabaret, Network, Easy Rider, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, All the President's Men, Patton, Fiddler on the Roof, The Deer Hunter, MASH, Harold and Maude, The Right Stuff, The Producers, Annie Hall, Tootsie, Manhattan, The Sting, Nashville, Midnight Cowboy, Blazing Saddles, Saturday Night Fever, Mead Streets, The French Connection, The King of Comedy, Sophie's Choice, Kramer vs. Kramer, The Last Picture Show, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, Atlantic City, Last Tango in Paris, Badlands, The Big Chill, In the Heat of the Night, On Golden Pond, The Wild Bunch, Love Story, Cool Hand Luke, Funny Girl, Dog Day Afternoon, Five Easy Pieces, Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, An Unmarried Woman, Days of Heaven, El Norte, The Goodbye Girl, Harry and Tonto, In Cold Blood, Little Big Man, Local Hero, The Man Who Would Be King, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Melvin and Howard, Missing, Reds, Tender Mercies, Terms of Endearment. Human-sized movies about human beings, stories made by humans for humans, stories made by adults for adults about adults. Collaboration between people of opposite temperament who can't stand each other and therefore tear each other's work to shreds in the name of collaboration. Don't let anybody fool you. Collaboration is a shit sandwich, the success of which depends not at all on the strength of your brain, but on the strength of your stomach. Nobody lusts for the power that comes with a career in making money in commerce or making alternate universes in the arts or the profane marriage between the two, that is movies, if they have a strong stomach for being contradicted. Everyone wants to be rich and famous for the greater validation, but wealth and fame are the greatest tools for invalidation the world has yet created. The more privilege we seek, the more entitlement we achieve, the more focus we become for other people's resentments. The greater the potential for love, the greater the potential for hate. Being human is a difficult task to bear at the best of times. So perhaps these volatile times that were the turbulent 1970s were an exceedingly human era, when all the dark urges of humanity came together to check each other, as they always do in a great democracy, grinding their human waste in hours into a humane fertilizer that grew the most beautiful of all American gardens. a garden of humanity infertile and cultivated by the tension between creative people and realistic people, people who give and people who take, people who dream and people who scheme, people who measure quality and people who measure quantity, people who take responsibility and people who put responsibility off, people who take credit and people happy to give a little credit away in exchange for gross percentage points, people who live forever and people happy to enjoy themselves on the way down. A garden made possible because people of vastly different perspectives and experiences and temperaments came together to add their particular facet of humanity to a full equation that could give movies a more complete picture of who we are before the dark times, before the empire. It's not that movie franchises like Star Wars and Indiana Jones were worse than the movies that came before them. It's just that making them meant that other kinds of movies would more seldom be made. The addicts realized that they didn't just have to bet the house against the house. They could mortgage the whole f***ing neighborhood. Every movie championed by a studio would no longer speak to the adult or the human or the humane or the organic, but to the kid, the pubescent, the teenager, the preservative, the animal, and everybody who still wants to engorge himself on candy, on explosions, on masturbation, on blood. Even the adult stories have to become more sensational and less human just to keep up. Every year, a director who wants to tell a human story finds it harder and harder to get it onto the screen. Either make the compromises demanded up by these coked-up alter cockers, or strike it out on your own with European or Broadway producers grateful to be connected with someone from Hollywood, but who can cough up a quarter of the budget on a good day with worse actors and worse production teams. And somehow, during this period when the movie theater became the multiplex, there was only a single name consistently affixed to the last credit of the blockbuster movies whose ethnic signature affixed a seal of quality. Sure, there were a few movies to hit the $100 million mark with a directorial credit of the mosaic affixture. Movies like Superman 1 and 2, Beverly Hills Cop, Star Trek 4, Ghostbusters, Three Men and a Baby, Good Morning Vietnam, all of them hit the $100 million mark when $100 million was nearly impossible to hit. But no more than two of them had the same director. Between 1980 and 2000, if a Jewish producer wanted to mega hit, he offered it to directors with names like Lucas, Scott, Zemeckis, Howard, Cameron, Columbus, Burton, and Emmerich. These were not stories you could afford to take chances on to make them better. These were investments designed to be the safest possible revenue generators. They were properties with car chases and terrorists with guns on a plane and computers hooked up to a bomb and counting down clock. Every Jew knows that when you buy a property, the first thing you do is hire a goyish handyman. And so when a project comes along that's designed to be so beloved that it makes hundreds of millions, projects like Alien or Back to the Future or Terminator 2 or Forrest Gump or Apollo 13 or Gladiator or Castaway or How the Grinch Stole Christmas, you don't want another argumentative Jew screwing it up for you. Not Stanley Kubrick, not Woody Allen, not Mel Brooks, not Albert Brooks, not James L. Brooks, not Richard Brooks, not Bogdanovich, not Brest, not Benjamin, not Cohn, not Cronenberg, not Donen, not Donna, not Efron, not Fleischer, not Friedkin, not Fuller, not Guest, not Heckerling, not Herskovitz, not Hiller, not Hyams, not Kasten, not Kirshner, not Landis, not Leder, not Levinson, not Lumet, not Mann, not May, not Mazursky, not Myers, not Nichols, not Oz, not Pakula, not Penn, not Polanski, not Pollock, not Rafelson, not Ramey, not Ramis, not Reitman, not Ritt, not Schlesinger, not Siegel, not Sonnenfeld, not Wilder, not Winkler, not Zinnemann, not Zwick, and certainly not the Zucker brothers. It's not like these relative schlamazels lacked for work. It's not even like most of them lacked for occasional hits. But even the hits were kidnapped into some more agreeable director's hands for the inevitably inferior sequel. Whether it was Fader or producers, something was always conspiring against them, working their ways up to the A-plus list. Richard Donner created the Superman movies and Lethal Weapon and even the Goonies. But every time he created a new franchise, producers took it away from his hands, and always to the franchise's detriment. After Donner, even the directors of hits are confined to specific genre ghettos. Ivan Reitman made comedy hit after comedy hit in the 1980s, but even if Ghostbusters had more effects than your average Steve McQueen picture, he's just a comedy director, and he was never allowed to make the movies with the freedom that his son Jason now runs marathons with. Barry Sonnenfeld made all kinds of offbeat hits in the 90s, and he was so hilarious that Letterman would have him on just to chat when he wasn't promoting anything. But he was only the guy you hired for weird movies when you couldn't get Tim Burton. If a producer wanted a mega hit that broke every record, then he wanted somebody who could speak the language of flyover country. The producer wanted a technician accustomed to following instructions to the letter without asking why. The producer wanted a cultural ambassador who could be profiled on the Today Show and Good Morning America and seem like somebody you could have a beer with. And thus began the regime of the new Hollywood. Behind the desk, the schmutzige schmucks are still running everything. Even Disney is now run by guys named Eisner and Ovitz. In front of the camera, there are more Jews than ever, and they're openly Jewish. But behind the camera, there is only one Spielberg.
So I've wanted to ask you, did you know any Jews here in Duluth?
Just one. Arnold Kaufman. He died last year, but he ran Kaufman's department store on West Superior Street. His father, Julius, had a corner store in Central Hillside. His grandfather, Adolf, had a pushcart on which he sold vegetables. His daughter went into the advertising business in Minneapolis, and his granddaughter, Julia St. Christopher, had a guest spot a couple years ago on NCIS.
It sounds like you've kept up with him.
There isn't much else to do here.
But you sound especially close with Arnold Kaufman, if you know all that.
I didn't like him.
Oh?
He was always trying to make jokes, always trying to make you feel like you were his friend. And he was always advertising himself on TV. When the shipments came, he'd always count the individual shipments to make sure none of the workers stole anything. And he wouldn't let the workers leave until he did.
That just sounds like he was a good businessman.
We don't need good businessmen here. We just need people who let things be.
Were you a businessman?
I was his partner.
Spielberg was the presentation the new Hollywood gave of what it was. Growing up in an Orthodox family that moved around every part of America and therefore knew America better than Americanas did themselves. After he grows up, his religion is no longer Hashem. His religion is movies, with occasional dabbles into worshiping America outright. Even if he doesn't keep the customs of Judaism, he at least seems to conduct himself with Judeo-Christian values that could be appreciated even in the Bible Belt. He seems to try his best to be a family man in his spare time, and his movies are much less comfortable in compromising adult situations than they are with machines, with children, with merchandise, with figures and tabulations. His movies are filled with a longing for unfulfillable American ideals, ideals that were best preached in the old Hollywood by directors who were either immigrants or the children of them. Luminous footnotes to American history like Capra, Wyler, Cukor, Preminger, Minnelli, Kazan, and Kramer. Even John Ford wasn't from the Old West. He was from Maine. All these other Jews were trying to invent a formula for how to make art movies into something commercial. But Spielberg showed how to make commercialism into art. The now aging Gonovs have finally figured out the game. Why worry about whether something good can become crap when you can make crap into something good? With a respectable front, they can put more money than ever into cocaine and would-be starlets, whom blow prevents them from getting enough to f**k, and mansions bigger than anything their doctor or lawyer brothers and nephews ever bought back east. And Steven Spielberg made it all possible. Aristocrats in court can carry on their meaningless affairs whose problems they never have to answer for, so long as the court Jew keeps bringing in the money. Spielberg was, in some senses still is, America's court Jew. While all the other creative talents with a clipped dick begin to be bottled back up into their ghetto by their Jewish brothers, because these guys weren't just chazers, they were coppers. In every major court in old Europe, there was a Jew who found the way to keep money raking in so that the aristocrats could keep their party going for a few decades after everybody thought they mended their youthful ways and retreated to bourgeois domesticity. Eventually, all these courts crumbled to the ground and the court Jews were murdered en masse with the ghetto Jews. The only meaningful difference between America and old Europe being that in this part of America, the aristocrats are Jewish, and no Jew stays an aristocrat for long. Eventually, the sins of every one of these alter parishes catch up with them. You can't have an endless string of hits, and when every hit has to be bigger than the last, eventually you're going to make a flop so spectacular that no amount of money brought in from hits can make up for what you just lost. These are men whom cancer may spare until their 80s, but by 60, they're all dead in every way that counts to them. They're replaced by Spielberg clones, not just bland Goyim behind the camera, and eventually bland Jews too, like Abrams and Ratner and Singer, who might as well be Goyim, but bland Jews and bland Goyim alike behind the desk, who may not have nearly as much integrity as they claim, but who can at least put a safe face on Hollywood. They don't like adult situations any more than Spielberg does, and they all share a preference for the Spielberg specialties of special effects, superheroes, sentimentalities, salary in the sophomoric. Maybe the movies were never an art with a capital A, but they sure as hell aren't now, and they were a lot more exciting back then. Once upon a time, the movies were a roulette wheel, but today, they're a Walmart aisle.
So, how did Herbert end up the way he was?
We never figured Herb out. He was always different, so we just let him be and find his own way.
What would he have been like if he wasn't so different?
He always cared so much. When he was a kid, he was a Lutheran through and through. If a salad had any lettuce, he would throw it out.
Is that something Lutherans do?
Salad without lettuce is just something we know we have to do. It's like the birds flying south for the winter. It's the same thing about being clean for communion. When it was time to do communion, Herb would just march his cousins into the bathroom to make sure their hands were completely washed, and if their hair wasn't still wet, he would block them.
Block them from the chapel? Really?
He was 6'7" by the time he was 13, so he was pretty easy.
When did you know that he was attracted to Judaism?
In retrospect, we should have known when he was 17. He saved up enough money to get a nose job.
A nose job?
He didn't think it was crooked enough.
What about when he went to college?
Herbert never went to college.
What?
He worked at Stenhammer Farms from the time he was 12. He was there for 23 years.
Oh, really?
Jim Stenhammer called him the best pork butcher he ever had.
Oh, my God!
But then he wouldn't drink on the job with everybody else, and he started making us go 100 miles just to find an all-you-can-eat Chinese buffet.
Well, everybody knows how much we love those.
We wanted to go on a family trip to Civil War battlefields, but he wouldn't go unless we spent the majority of the trip in Fort Lauderdale.
That's really Jewish.
His niece tried to go goth for a few months, and every time he'd see her, he'd come out of the bathroom with some tissues and Windex to try to wipe her makeup off.
That's our Rabbi Swamley.
He put sugar in the gas tank of our RV. He threw a casserole out we made him. And when his mother bought him a sweater at the Cracker Barrel, he demanded the receipt so he could return it and get a full refund.
You should have known where he was heading by then.
Pretty soon he wouldn't even mow his own lawn and hired his neighbors to do the landscaping. He'd talk over everybody at Sunday dinner. And when I tried to listen to Jimmy Buffett, he took a baseball bat to the radio.
Well, I've never met a Jew who liked Jimmy Buffett.
Then he started talking in this weird accent. He sold his motorcycle. He turned in his Boy Scout membership, and he made his brother-in-law fix his car for him.
What was the moment when you realized he was turning into a Jew?
I'd say it was when he started stooping his shoulders over to make himself a foot shorter.
What was the indicator there?
All the Kaufmans had terrible posture. And one time this relative from Israel came to town.
I'm guessing you really didn't like that guy.
He was the rudest man I'd ever met in my life.
Sounds about right.
He wanted to go into business with me and sell molasses in Israel, which is apparently very hard to find there. But he wouldn't take no for an answer. So finally I said yes, and he told me he wasn't interested anymore.
That definitely sounds like an Israeli.
He wanted to buy camo from us to sell back in Israel in bulk, and he wanted to negotiate our price. When we didn't agree, he just took the camo from our back room.
That really sounds like an Israeli.
Arnie made him give it back, and apparently they never spoke again.
Hey, what an amazing culture they have.
The day after he left, our Herbert started talking with that accent.
I'm sure you were thrilled.
It was the most irritated I'd ever seen his mother.
I'm sure it was very weird to hear.
All she said to him was, "Stop talking like a Jew," and he called her an anti-Semite and cried for 2.5 hours.
We're not exactly subtle about our emotions.
I'd never seen Herbert cry in his life.
I have.
We thought we knew our Herbert.
He sounded very different.
What do you think precipitated the change?
I have no idea. I didn't know him back then, but a lot of Goyim are attracted to Judaism because we're not so settled as you are.
I know. I don't like you people.
Of course it's pointless to give too much detail of what follows because it's so predictable. Except to say that when the producer gave his speech, he was 2 months away from getting his comeuppance, and he knew it. The particular big-budget film that currently held his ass on the line was going to be a fiasco. Every film he ever made seemed like it would be a disaster while filming. But something in the transfer to celluloid and the final cut turned them to gold. Hit after hit, some of which he thought and knew were far less than good, a few of which were even abysmal. And yet all these feinschmeckers were either too stupid to love them or smart enough to pretend to love them to their friends, to their co-workers, to their family members, to their newspaper editors. But even in an era when no one could do wrong, one is beset by the fear of its conclusion. In the last 2 years, he saw a full half a dozen of his friends and enemies, which were which, wiped out by productions that 5 years ago would have been sprinkled with that magic movie dust that even made bad movies into great ones, perhaps especially bad movies. And he wondered when his time would come. There was an incurable virus coursing through the Hollywood air that made cinematic disasters turn out just as badly in Final Cut as they seemed in dailies. Such a moment in his life was how women like Carmen appealed to him and hundreds of other Hollywood insiders. Yet another true Hollywood original to add to the pile of them that he alone would take credit for discovering and he alone would mentor. A beauty with distinctions and intelligence and particulars of charisma that no other Hollywood beauty yet resembled. But also precisely why the arc of what happens next is so painfully obvious. She was discovered at the precise moment when Hollywood craved generic, anonymous beauty from generic, anonymous, white-bred Americans that could be manufactured in a Sara Lee assembly line, then set off to Weight Watchers for packaging. The producer's speech was to the film and theater students, and the theme was some crap like believing in yourself and following your dreams. Carmen had just starred in a USC production of The Pajama Game. Never would a character once played by Doris Day look more swarthy and freckled and ginger and buxom. Carmen had no intention of switching her major to theater. She wanted to be a concert pianist. But the theater department was courting her heavily to switch and invited her for a third-row seat to his lecture. He absconded ASAP before any student had the opportunity to speak to him. But the night after he gave the talk, the producer happened to be at the Cobra Inn in El Monte, a town way out in the San Gabriel Valley where Carmen sang jazz and country on the piano 3 nights a week. As she sang, as she played piano, as she sang on the piano, she knew, as all altos do, that the power of her musical ability was paltry in its spell next to how her form-hugging, low-cut red dresses could burrow into the souls of the divorced men, the veterans, the farmers, the factory workers, drunk enough to tip her their kids' lunch money if she talked to them for 90 seconds and kept mace in her purse. The producer came alone and took a seat in the empty front row table. No one accompanying him except for a faithful chauffeur who waited in the Mercedes limo outside with the air conditioning on and the Godfather of Soul playing on the radio. Within a week, she'd quit Cobra, and he bought her an entire formal wardrobe. Within 3 weeks, he'd bought her parents' convertibles and given them a copy of his personal credit card during the week of their anniversary with instructions to go to any restaurants they wanted. She never saw him pick up any of the leather-bound books in the many shelves of his drawing room. The producer assured her that he read for 2 hours every night before he joined her in bed. But rather than the reverent and relaxing silence that accompanies reading for many of us, she usually heard him shouting loudly as the TV broadcast the Lakers and Dodgers games at a booming volume. Even so, he seemed able to talk about books with endless fluency in his Upper West Side accent, which he tweaked to sound more Upper East. Give the pattern of class he worked so hard like a horse to acquire. The producer inevitably thought Carmen's love was jazz, so there was jazz practically every night, from the lowest B-grade open jam at which he made her play piano to front-row tickets at Miles and Dizzy and Ella and Frankie and Tony and Benny and Nina and Etta and Lena and Tojo and Herbie and Duke Jr. If it was a big show, he didn't even need a backstage pass to get through. Doormen and bouncers all called him by his name, and he'd tip them in wads. They'd all talk on a backstage sofa while the ravenous musicians were served on a lavish post-show meal, and he'd pull out a bottle of scotch from his jacket and light up a joint for them, or sometimes even cut a line with his utilitarian credit card. After the fifth time she told him what she really loved was classical music, he started surprising her on weekends with box seats at Chandler to see Zubin conduct at the L.A. Phil, and they would inevitably meet up afterward with him and Nancy and whoever the soloist was that week. Horowitz, Pavarotti, Domingo, Barenboim, Stern, Perlman, Menuhin, Sills, Milstein, Ashkenazi, Argerich, De La Rocha. In the span of 18 months, she got to meet them all. Whenever a pianist came to town, Carmen would ask them to come around the house after the Sunday 2 p.m. matinee, and the pianist would claim to be delighted to hear her play or play four-hand duets with her on the Bösendorf piano, which the producer shipped overnight from Vienna for her when she moved in on the fifth day of their relationship. And yet, between 4 and 6 the next day, there was always a call. Barenboim had to get back to London to look after his ailing wife. Ashkenazi had to deal with trouble at the Soviet consulate. Argerich was under the weather from their drinking. De La Rocha had to practice her next week's program. Horowitz was too tired from last night's concert. That one hurt the most by far. And then there were the long weekends with a couple of real celebrities who needed to unwind from their shoots to play some tennis in the evening, followed by drinks and coke before dinner, then cigars and weed after. Booze it all throughout, and God knows how many unlikely pairings heading into a bedroom of the guest cottage in between. Every famous pairing of the age, every famous solo act made their appearance, and by the end of the night, who knows how many of these celebrity pairings left on the arm of the better half with which they entered. Carmen and the producer played host to a veritable museum of the new Hollywood. Irish Nicholson and Toots Houston, Beatty and Keaton, Guess who made a pass at Carmen? A great one, of course. Bobby Wagner and Tasha Wood. She wasn't nice to Carmen. Dusty Hoffman and Ann, Bogdanovich and Dorothy, who got very drunk and was pulled off the bar she was dancing on, whereupon she made an even bigger scene. Pacino and Kathleen Quinlan, Faye Dunaway, threw a plate. Bobby De Niro and Diane, Bobby of course said nothing all night. Michael Caine and Shakira, Carson and Joanna, McQueen and McGraw, together before the divorce, separately after. Gore Vidal and Howard, how could anybody be so hilarious and so mean at the same time? Dickie Burton and Susie. Dickie showed up drunk and got more gloomy and obnoxious as the night went on. De Palma and Nancy, Spielberg and Amy, Paul and Joanne. Oh, what a nice couple. It's Clint and Sandra, Friedkin and Sean Moreau. Everybody left the room when they started fighting. Charlton and Lydia, Carrie and Barbara. And Carmen could swear old Carrie was making a pass at the producer. Larry Olivier and Joan, Kirk Douglas and Anne. Though Kirk tried to get fresh with Carmen outside the ladies' room. Woody and Stacy. For once, she wasn't the youngest one there. Streep and Cazale when John was feeling up to it. Dougie Fairbanks and Mary. Francis Coppola and Eleanor. Francis yelled at him the whole time. Scorsese and Isabella Rossellini, the most beautiful woman she'd ever seen in person. Sean Connery and Michelin. You don't even want to know. Lenny Bernstein and MTV. Arms all over each other. Lenny talked for 3 hours without a break. MTT tried to get a word in and failed. Everybody was half asleep, but Carmen was riveted. Cavett and Carey, Orson and Oya. Finished a spread alone that the Nicholsons, the Beatties, and the Hoffmans couldn't eat half of. Jody before she had to go to bed. Merv Griffin once showed up with a male escort. Even Henry Miller hobbled through the backyard garden one day. Even Ted Kennedy and Kissinger. Every week, the producer brought Carmen a new book to read. Once every 3 months or so, his pilot would fly them to a weekend in the south of France, or the north of Italy, or Lake Lucerne, or the island of Mykonos, or the Picos de Europa Mountains. The concierges and the waiters even knew his name there. But need we that you read the price at which said high life is procured? Need we state the details of utter imbalance that puts Carmen in the company of the world's cultural elite, but unable to say a word unless spoken to? Play hostess to the world's most famous people every night, but held responsible by this declining Hollywood player for everything his servants do wrong and subject to endless berating for their mistakes in preparation and hers in conversation after the guests leave, and therefore to say little as well about the imbalance between a declining producer and the coddled Hollywood stars upon whom this producer's very sense of self is dependent. Need we enflesh how this Hollywood player had a vertigo-like obsession with the details of Carmen's appearance, her hair, her dress, her eyes, her nails, the appointments every day with stylists, designers, tailors, plastic surgeons? Need we detail how the producer emerged unannounced from some corner of USC to accuse her of talking to some USC film brat for too long? Need we detail the many private scenes that seem cribbed from a Golden Age Betty Davis melodrama? Need we elucidate the occasional death threat, the many blows to the stomach so as not to damage her face, in front of the servants, no less, the many times she heard female voices in the background of phone calls, the many times he told her how much more beautiful and less snobby were the hundreds and hundreds of other women he had, before her, of course, the all too many times when she was ignored when pleading with him to stop and do something else to her? Need we elaborate upon the many small and futile attempts Carmen made to take revenges upon her producer that, in the parlance of our own era, could perhaps be called microaggressions? Certainly not microaggressions in their intent or ferocity, but microaggression in proportion to the degree of perpetration upon her, and incontrovertibly micro in their degree of effectiveness. Aggressions that endowed her with satisfaction for only split seconds before the anxiety and or the terror returns to full force. The knife she once pulled on him, the heavy objects thrown, the screaming until she was hoarse, the loving stares at his gun collection, the worst imaginable pains she could inflict during sex, which relief followed by endless aggravation and a little horror amidst the validation he seemed to enjoy more than ever. Who knows if Carmen was actually in love? Did it matter? The producer was not so much something to be treasured or hated by Carmen as something that happened to her. All the good, all the bad, all that she learned or didn't, all the coke and cock was not of her doing. She was a passenger in a Mercedes that the drunk driver locks from the outside while getting loaded and then returns for the simple pleasure of banging up something beautiful. Instead of detailing all this, your ever-reliable narrator will tell but one simple story of the night her producer became a finished producer. It was dinner at the house with Janet and Marty Sheen, Ramon to friends. Nolte, a couple of lawyers and their wives who brought 50-year-old scotch and choice-cut coke, Marshall and John Voight, the producer and Carmen, on an unseasonably frigid February night. Ramon was back from the set of Apocalypse Now, having wrapped up the shooting, or maybe he'd quit for something like the third time, or maybe this was while he was recuperating from his onset heart attack. And this was to be a welcome home dinner that spared no expense for a movie star who needed a perfect comeback after starring in a film that everybody in Hollywood knew would be a disaster. It was relatively early in the relationship, and in retrospect, the one time at which the producer seemed truly pleased with Carmen's hosting abilities. Neither the cook nor the pastry chef did a single thing wrong, for which he held Carmen as responsible as when they didn't. The Galician wines bought to impress Ramon were perfect. Conversation flowed freely. Carmen turned down Nolte's blatant passes at the table with magnificently self-effacing assurance. The then ex-Catholic and Marxist Voight promised to be on his best behavior with the extremely Catholic Ramon when it came to questions about the new anti-communist pope, and mostly fulfilled his pledge. Little did anyone know how vehemently they would switch political sides in 20 years. Around 11, the producer got a call that he took in his office. He emerged and didn't say anything for the rest of the night except for the cursory goodbye to Ramon and Janet 2 in the morning when they left early to get some sleep before their flight tomorrow to Bermuda. From the glances that darted around the room, everybody knew that something was wrong. But only Nolte, a man who looks for danger like a hammer does for a nail, was brave and stupid enough to broach it. For Nolte's troubles and concern, the producer threw the entire fucking room out of his house. That was around 3:30. The producer and Carmen sat on a sofa downstairs with a small hill of cocaine on the coffee table. The producer would not tell her what it was about, but changed the subject by complimenting her hosting abilities profusely. After an hour and a half of using every roundabout way of trying to get it out of him, she shrugged her shoulders and went upstairs to find her Xanax for bed. It was somewhere in the area of 5:30 to 6 that the producer came upstairs. The sun was already coming up, and the Southern California glowed with morning light. With a subtly mischievous grin, he told Carmen that she was ready to know the secret of making good movies. Did she want to know? Of course she did. And because she did, the producer dangled her by her feet from the fourth floor bedroom window. It is something approaching inconceivability that Carmen could remember every word of something so incoherent while lying down in winter air more suited for Latvia than Los Angeles. But as we've already seen, Carmen's ability to retain information at this point in her life was something approaching miraculousness. Unfortunately for her, a memory both photographic and phonographic in its ability to recall detail, regardless of how harrowing.
Here's the fucking secret, you freeloading cunt! Secret is right in front of your motherfucking Quasimodo face! Look at it, that secret, you filth! Touch it! Kiss it! Take it all fucking in, because the secret is danger! You're gonna fucking love danger! Do you love danger?
Of course, she said yes.
I said, do you love danger? You're gonna look for danger wherever you fucking go. You're gonna be the goddess who plays with the danger for your lion horse sport. You're gonna be the Shiksa goddess of death who plays with the sands of the fucking kingdom, or the fucking foundation, or the fucking splendor, or the fucking eternity, or the fucking wisdom, or the fucking beauty, or the fucking severity, or the fucking kindness, or the fucking understanding, or the fucking wisdom, or the fucking crown. You're gonna be unmerciful before they sin, and you're gonna be unmerciful after they sin, and you're gonna be unmerciful all over the people you rule, and you're gonna be unmerciful for the people who are tempted, and then you're going to be unmerciful for the people who don't deserve mercy, and then you're going to be unmerciful to the people who deserve mercy, and then you're going to be unmerciful to the people, and you're going to be quick to anger and small in kindness and never tell the truth and be unforgiving of evil and be unforgiving of the good and end all generations and us. You and me, du und ihr, and I am the Alpha and you're the Omega, and together we're going to be the reason everything happened right until fucking now, when you stare down to the ground and scream with your whore mouth and get rid of the fucking years or so, because you're going to be alone with death and eat a meal with death and beat death's family and wear its fucking rib claws and go to death's parties and say prayers for death and remember death once a fucking year after you die, because you're not in here in this shadowy dank hole, but out there where you are in the endless light, when you're staring down and up and left and right into the shape without form and the shape without color and the paralyzed force and the gesture without motion, some those who have crossed with the red eyes and the death's other kingdoms, you'll remember us, not that the violent souls, but that hollow men, because you can see the light clearly and shape it and bless it like the fucking clay of earth and plan time and light like fucking infinite vistas of the light with your mind, and you listen to it and you listen to the listening but making allowance for the doubtings. So if you can wait and not be tired by the waiting, and then you can fucking lie about it, since I deal in lies because it's impossible to describe what's necessary to those who don't know what horror is, because horror is a face and you must make a friend of horror, because horror and terror, you're fucking friends, because if they're not, then your enemies you fear. So you're going to take yourself by a roll of the fucking book and write upon it all the fucking words that I have spoken unto you about me, Israel, and ye, Babylon, and get rid of the thousand years sorrow put on us by all the whores of Babylon from the day I spoke unto ye, even unto this day, when there's no trace left of Yankel and red. You're always going to see something to dispose of your head and leaves a heap of dirty ashes, because a live fresh-cut nerve is infinitely more sensitive. I just drill into the healthy tooth until I reach the pulp, because you know that, man, I'm fucking Zell, I'm divisive fucking angel, and you'll never stop me. Yet though you walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you will fear no evil, because the person you're with is me, because my word is a lamp for your fucking feet and a light on your fucking path, and I'm the fucking light and your fucking salvation, because folly is 100 fucking times better than wisdom. You're going to be struck down and become more powerful than you can possibly imagine, and when you die, I'll take you and cut out the stars and make a face of the heavens so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish fucking sun. Because I chose you, honey, from all the women in the fucking world to be mother to my only living son in 1979, the year 13, because God is dead and Satan reigns. So remember, when you're eating the mouse, you dirty, stinking secret keeper, with your snips and snails and puppy dog tails, you're going to come from another world and be the rock, be the tin can, and open the door to the new world and be stupid enough to blow yourself off the face of the fucking earth, and it'll smart when you breathe after I cut you in the nose while shaping, because the fish will be served with the head, and we don't accept people of the Jewish persuasion here, and neither does Dad, because he screws just like a Chinaman. You might think you know what you're dealing with, but believe me, you don't. Each night you're going to count the fucking stars, and each night you're going to get the same fucking number, and when they don't come to be counted, you're going to count the fucking holes they leave. You're going to be the mother and the daughter and bring LA to the border and give them an offer they can't refuse as you leave the gun and take the cannoli. You're going to have the naive presidents and the senators killed with their brains and their signatures on the contract after you tell them that you're innocent. You'll let them suffer as much as you suffer, because I don't ask for respect. I don't offer friendship, and you're going to fear to be in my debt, and the scum that ruins you will suffer this very day, or any other, because you're going to throw it away just to make me look ridiculous. I made my bones and then out the cheerleaders, and the whole fucking time I took sides against the family and dishonored it and took the freedom, and while you can't weep because of the pain, I spent my whole life trying not to be careless, and I'm telling you right now, you will never be beautiful again, because I'm going to make this baby an orphan before he's fucking born. This is your soul's hour, then you sleep with the fishes and the free fucking flight from the world this fucking night, and the sleep and the death and the stars, and I'll grant your stupid loftiness the goddamn right to some degree of cloud, and from the stars your judgment will perk up so you can climb into heaven and gaze on the fucking earth and wander companionless among the stars like the fucking night of the cloudless climbs in the starry fucking skies. And you'll wander through the fucking ghetto from lane to useless fucking lane and find no solace and teach the little kids the stupid alphabet and get that useless fucking flag for the Hebrew letters. You gotta never want to forget, like you were shot through the diamond bullet through your head, you perfect, genuine, complete crystalline pure head, and to think you have astronomy not to tell the good and evil luck of plagues, the deaths of Satan, equality till China and Africa meet, and the river jumps over the mountain, and the salmon sing in the street, and the ocean is hung up to dry, and seven stars squawking like geese about the sky, because it's stronger than you, and I'm stronger than you. I'll strengthen you and help you with my righteous right hand as you grow older, and you understand how many tears lie in between the light of the fucking letters until you make a friend of the fucking horror and become the tears yourself. Keep your friends close, but your enemies closer, because I know how to return in favor, and I'll break your fucking heart with an abortion, and I'll take the captain of the command with me and wipe everybody out from the beginning to the end, to the end of the beginning, because if history's taught us anything, it's taught us that you can kill anybody. Then the men have vision and guts, and there's no plaque to any of them, because we stepped over our brothers, because I despised their whole masquerade and the dishonest way they posed themselves and their whole fucking family. You do business with them. You respect them. You'll never trust them. They're not a brother. They're not a friend. I don't know what they do. I don't want to see them at hotels. I don't want them near my house. Don't they know I will use all my power to prevent something like that from happening? All my strength? The strength to do it. I'll make lights in the heaven to divide the firmament and give light upon the earth. Because he determined the number of stars and give all of them their names, and be moral and utilize your instincts to kill without feeling the passion and without feeling the judgment, because it's judgment that'll fucking defeat you. The unrighteous, because the righteous perish, and no man lays at the heart, and no one understands the righteous perish to be taken away from evil. You're gonna go off the reservation of light and make your own fucking reservation on the infinite light, where they worship you as a goddess of death and be willing to kill yourself and kill me and kill the light, because you make your own rules in the light and reach a breaking point from the light and go beyond it into the light and go too far and admit it and stretch out the fucking heavens like a curtain and think it would be wrong or would it be right and will the light accept your will and refuse you and go without rain and burn for many years and cry without tears and making the fucking wind and the messenger and the fucking fire and the minister. And not be judged and disappear out into the light, into the jungle with your people and feel comfortable with your people because the light, because it's the judgment that defeats us with the lost violent souls out in the light. But what would your people back home want if they ever learned just how far you've really gone? Because you broke from them and you broke from me and you broke from yourself and you broke because you have no right to call me a murderer, but you have a right to kill me and make wars unto the ends of the earth and break the bow and cut the spear and burn the chariots and fire with Adoy Shem es Iyov min Hasora mizem machshich etzob v'milin bleed da'os, because life is not as sinister as the fucking night anymore, and nothing's closed anymore, and every door is open, and you're the one who does the fucking persecuting. When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy, shall I say, I have gone at dusk through narrow streets and watch the smoke that rises from the pipes of lonely men in shirt sleeves leaning out of windows.
And as his obedient partner in life, when he let her go from the ledge, she wrote it all down.
This has been a tale from the old new land. What is the old new land? Where is the old new land? It is a place where the supreme capacities of man can triumph over violence, power, and cruelty, where hypocrisy is tolerated because it is an indicator of humanity, not a strike against humanity, because humanism and liberality make hypocrisy inevitable, and the only place without hypocrisy is a place so blindly partisan that the hypocrisies can be concealed. It is a place where every hypocrite can aspire to be something greater because everyone's sins are exposed, and no one's sins are exposed to the point that some people's sins can be whitewashed. The old new land is a place where the shadows on the wall inspire the very best in us, where ideologies are shrugged at and the conspiracies of gruesome powers behind the scenes are quickly dismissed. It is a place where facts stand in the way of domination because facts hold such a fantastic pull upon us that they cannot be contradicted. It is the place where one man or one woman can stand up before a single monarch or a horde of spectators and dare a no when a yes is demanded. But once the dictator kills the subject who dares rebel, facts themselves cease to exist until he corroborates them. The dictator becomes an artist expressing himself through murder. When an artist endeavors to show the world as it is, he cannot change the world to fit his image of it. But when the tyrant endeavors to show the world as it is, he can change the world to fit his image of it precisely. We'll work and we'll work and we'll work and we'll wait and we'll wait and we'll wait. Because he will be thrown out of the old new land. So, you thought you were going to get information on me by going to my father?
Oh, dear.
I put a tracking device on your microphone. I knew where you were going.
Relax, Herbert. We were just reminiscing about the nice young man you were.
My name is Hillel, and I never was a nice young man.
I'm sure you were, Rabbi Swabber.
You stay out of this.
Herbert, your friend has just told me what a fine clergyman you are and how well-loved you are by your congregants.
But I never...
You're an amazing son. You always were, and we're so happy to have you in this family.
Well, I wish I was happy to have you as a father.
I know we've had our differences, but you've become a fine man with a wonderful career in a caring community.
Do you really believe that?
Of course I do. And I just want you to know I love you and I'm so proud of you.
Ach, I love my dear too, Tate.
Even if you are a kike swine.
Copyright 2016, AS21 Publishing, LLC, all rights reserved.
AS21 Publishing. What do you want your book to be?